Chapter 59. The reader is brought into communication with some professional persons, and sheds a tear over the filial piety of good Mr. Jonas. Mr. Pecksniff was in a hackney cabriolet, for Jonas Chuzzlewit had said spare no expense. Apostrophe mankind is evil in its thoughts and in its base constructions, and Jonas was resolved it should not have an inch to stretch into an ell against him. It never should be charged upon his father's son that he had grudged the money for his father's funeral. Hence, until the obsequies should be concluded, Jonas had taken for his motto spend, and spare not. Mr. Pecksniff had been to the undertaker, and was now upon his way to another officer in the train of mourning, a female functionary, a nurse, and watcher, and performer of nameless offices about the persons of the dead whom he had recommended. Her name, as Mr. Pecksniff gathered from a scrap of writing in his hand, was Gamp, her residence in Kingsgate Street, High Holborn. So Mr. Pecksniff, in a hackney cab, was rattling over Holborn Stones, in quest of Mrs. Gamp. This lady lodged at a bird fancier's, next door but one to the celebrated mutton pie shop, and directly opposite to the original cat's meat warehouse, the renown of which establishments was duly heralded on their respective fronts. It was a little house, and this was the more convenient, for Mrs. Gamp being, in her highest walk of art, a monthly nurse, or, as her signboard boldly added, midwife, and lodging in the first floor front, was easily assailable at night by pebbles, walking sticks, and fragments of tobacco pipe, all much more efficacious than the street door knocker, which was so constructed as to wake the street with ease, and even spread alarms of fire in Holborn, without making the smallest impression on the premises to which it was addressed. It chanced on this particular occasion that Mrs. Gamp had been up all the previous night, in attendance upon a ceremony to which the usage of gossips has given that name which expresses, in two syllables, the curse pronounced on Adam. It chanced that Mrs. Gamp had not been regularly engaged, but had been called in at a crisis, in consequence of her great repute, to assist another professional lady with her advice. And thus it happened that, all points of interest in the case being over, Mrs. Gamp had come home again to the bird fancier's and gone to bed. So when Mr. Pecksniff drove up in the hackney cab, Mrs. Gamp's curtains were drawn close, and Mrs. Gamp was fast asleep behind them. If the bird fancier had been at home, as he ought to have been, there would have been no great harm in this. But he was out, and his shop was closed. The shutters were down certainly, and in every pane of glass there was at least one tiny bird in a tiny bird cage, twittering and hopping his little ballet of despair, and knocking his head against the roof, while one unhappy goldfinch who lived outside a red villa with his name on the door, drew the water for his own drinking, and mutely appealed to some good man to drop a farthing's worth of poison in it. Still, the door was shut. Mr. Pecksniff tried the latch, and shook it, causing a cracked bell inside to ring most mournfully, but no one came. The bird fancier was an easy shaver also, and a fashionable hairdresser also, and perhaps he had been sent for, express, from the court end of the town, to trim a lord, or cut and curl a lady, but however that might be, there, upon his own ground, he was not. Nor was there any more distinct trace of him to assist the imagination of an inquirer than a professional printer emblem of his calling much favored in the trade, representing a hairdresser of easy manners curling a lady of distinguished fashion, in the presence of a patent upright grand pianoforte. Noting these circumstances, Mr. Pecksniff, in the innocence of his heart, applied himself to the knocker. But at the first double knock every window in the street became alive with female heads, and before he could repeat the performance whole troops of married ladies, some about to trouble Mrs. Gamp themselves very shortly, came flocking round the steps, all crying out with one accord, and with uncommon interest, "Knock at the winder, sir, knock at the winder. Lord bless you, don't lose no more time than you can help, knock at the winder. acting upon this suggestion, and borrowing the driver's whip for the purpose, Mr. Pecksniff soon made a commotion among the first floor flower pots, and roused Mrs. Gamp, whose voice, to the great satisfaction of the matrons, was heard to say, "I'm coming." "He's as pale as a muffin," said one lady, in allusion to Mr. Pecksniff. "So he ought to be, if he's the feelings of a man," observed another. A third lady, with her arms folded, said she wished he had chosen any other time for fetching Mrs. Gamp, but it always happened so with her. It gave Mr. Pecksniff much uneasiness to find, from these remarks, that he was supposed to have come to Mrs. Gamp upon an errand touching not the close of life, but the other end. Mrs. Gamp herself was under the same impression, for, throwing open the window, she cried behind the curtains, as she hastily attired herself, "Is it Mrs. Perkins?" "No." returned Mr. Pecksniff, sharply. "Nothing of the sort." "What, Mr. Wilkes?" cried Mrs. Gamp. "Don't say it's you, Mr. Wilkes, and that poor creature Mrs. Wilkes with, not even a pincushion ready. Don't say it's you, Mr. Wilkes." "It isn't Mr. Wilkes," said Pecksniff. "I don't know the man. Nothing of the kind. A gentleman is dead, and some person being wanted in the house, you have been recommended by Mr. Mole the undertaker." As she was by this time in a condition to appear, Mrs. Gamp, who had a face for all occasions, looked out of the window with her mourning countenance, and said she would be down directly. But the matrons took it very ill that Mr. Pecksniff's mission was of so unimportant a kind, and the lady with her arms folded rated him in good round terms, signifying that she would be glad to know what he meant by terrifying delicate females with his corpses, and giving it as her opinion that he was quite ugly enough to know better. The other ladies were not at all behindhand in expressing similar sentiments, and the children, of whom some scores had now collected, hooted and defied Mr. Pecksniff quite savagely. So when Mrs. Gamp appeared, the unoffending gentleman was glad to hustle her with very little ceremony into the cabriolet, and drive off, overwhelmed with popular execration. Mrs. Gamp had a large bundle with her, a pair of pattens, and a species of gig umbrella, the latter article in color like a faded leaf, except where a circular patch of a lively blue had been dexterously let in at the top. She was much flurried by the haste she had made, and labored under the most erroneous views of cabriolets, which she appeared to confound with mail coaches or stage wagons, inasmuch as she was constantly endeavoring for the first half mile to force her luggage through the little front window, and clamoring to the driver to put it in the boot. When she was disabused of this idea, her whole being resolved itself into an absorbing anxiety about her pattens, with which she played innumerable games at quoits on Mr. Pecksniff's legs. It was not until they were close upon the house of mourning that she had enough composure to observe, "And so the gentleman's dead, sir. Ah, the more's the pity." She didn't even know his name. "But it's what we must all come to. It's as certain as being born, except that we can't make our calculations as exact. Ah, poor dear." She was a fat old woman, this Mrs. Gamp, with a husky voice and a moist eye, which she had a remarkable power of turning up, and only showing the white of it. Having very little neck, it cost her some trouble to look over herself, if one may say so, at those to whom she talked. She wore a very rusty black gown, rather the worse for snuff, and a shawl and bonnet to correspond. In these dilapidated articles of dress she had, on principle, arrayed herself, time out of mind, on such occasions as the present, for this at once expressed a decent amount of veneration for the deceased, and invited the next of kin to present her with a fresher suit of weeds, an appeal so frequently successful that the very fetch and ghost of Mrs. Camp, bonnet and all, might be seen hanging up any hour in the day in at least a dozen of the second-hand clothes shops about Holborn. The face of Mrs. Camp, the nose in particular, was somewhat red and swollen, and it was difficult to enjoy her society without becoming conscious of a smell of spirits. Like most persons who have attained to great eminence in their profession, she took to hers very kindly, insomuch that, setting aside her natural predilections as a woman, she went to a lying in, or a laying out with equal zest and relish. Ah! repeated Mrs. Camp, for it was always a safe sentiment in cases of mourning. Ah dear! When Camp was summoned to his long home, and I see him a lying in Guy's hospital with a penny piece on each eye, and his wooden leg under his left arm, I thought I should have fainted away. But I bore up. If certain whispers current in the Kingsgate Street circles had any truth in them, she had indeed borne up surprisingly, and had exerted such uncommon fortitude as to dispose of Mr. Gamp's remains for the benefit of science. But it should be added, in fairness, that this had happened 20 years before, and that Mr. and Mrs. Gamp had long been separated on the ground of incompatibility of temper in their drink. You have become indifferent since then, I suppose? Said Mr. Pecksniff. Use is second nature, Mrs. Gamp. You may well say second nature, sir, returned that lady. One's first ways is to find such things a trial to the feelings, and so is one's lasting custom. If it wasn't for the nerve a little sip of liquor gives me, I never was able to do more than taste it. I never could go through with what I sometimes has to do. Mrs. Harris, I says, at the very last case as ever I acted in, which it was but a young person, Mrs. Harris, I says, leave the bottle on the chimney piece, and don't ask me to take none, but let me put my lips to it when I am so dispatched, and then I will do what I'm engaged to do, according to the best of my ability. Mrs. Camp, she says, in answer, if ever there was a sober creature, to be got at 18 pence a day for working people, and 3 and 6 for gentlefolks night watching, said Mrs. Camp with emphasis, being a extra charge you are that inwoolable person. Mrs. Harris, I says to her, don't name the charge, for if I could afford to lay all my feller creatures out for nothing, I would gladly do it, such is the love I bears them. But what I always says to them as has the management of matters, Mrs. Harris here she kept her eye on Mr. Pecksniff, be they gents, or be they ladies, is, don't ask me whether I won't take none, or whether I will, but leave the bottle on the chimney piece, and let me put my lips to it when I am so dispatched. The conclusion of this affecting narrative brought them to the house. In the passage they encountered Mr. Mole the undertaker, a little elderly gentleman, bald, and in a suit of black, with a notebook in his hand, a massive gold watch chain dangling from his fob, and a face in which a queer attempt at melancholy was at odds with a smirk of satisfaction, so that he looked as a man might, who, in the very act of smacking his lips over choice old wine, tried to make believe it was physic. Well, Mrs. Camp, and how are you, Mrs. Camp? Said this gentleman, in a voice as soft as his step. Pretty well, I thank you, sir, dropping a curtsy. You'll be very particular here, Mrs. Camp. This is not a common case, Mrs. Camp. Let everything be very nice and comfortable, Mrs. Camp, if you please, said the undertaker, shaking his head with a solemn air. It shall be, sir, she replied, curtsying again. You knows me of old, sir, I hope. I hope so too, Mrs. Camp, said the undertaker. And I think so also. Mrs. Camp curtsied again. This is one of the most impressive cases, sir, he continued, addressing Mr. Pecksniff, that I have seen in the whole course of my professional experience. Indeed, Mr. Mold. cried that gentleman. Such affectionate regret, sir, I never saw. There is no limitation, there is positively no limitation, opening his eyes wide, and standing on tiptoe in point of expense. I have orders, sir, to put on my whole establishment of mutes, and mutes come very dear, Mr. Pecksniff, not to mention their drink. To provide silver-plated handles of the very best description, ornamented with angels' heads from the most expensive dyes. To be perfectly profuse in feathers. In short, sir, to turn out something absolutely gorgeous. Apostrophe, my friend Mr. Jonas is an excellent man, apostrophe said Mr. Pecksniff. I have seen a good deal of what is filial in my time, sir, apostrophe retorted Mould, and what is unfilial too. It is our lot. We come into the knowledge of those secrets. But anything so filial as this, anything so honorable to human nature, so calculated to reconcile all of us to the world we live in, never yet came under my observation. It only proves, sir, what was so forcibly observed by the lamented theatrical poet buried at Stratford, that there is good in everything. Apostrophe, it is very pleasant to hear you say so, Mr. Mould, apostrophe observed Pecksniff. You are very kind, sir. And what a man Mr. Chuzzlewit was, sir. Ah, what a man he was. You may talk of your Lord Mayors, apostrophe said Mould, waving his hand at the public in general, your sheriffs, your common councilmen, your trumpery, but show me a man in this city who is worthy to walk in the shoes of the departed Mr. Chuzzlewit. No, no, apostrophe cried Mould, with bitter sarcasm. Hang him up, sole him and heal him, and have him ready for his son against he's old enough to wear him. But don't try them on yourselves, for they won't fit you. We knew him, apostrophe said Mould, in the same biting vein, as he pocketed his notebook. We knew him, and are not to be caught with chaff. Mr. Pecksniff, sir, good morning. Apostrophe, Mr. Pecksniff returned the compliment, and Mould, sensible of having distinguished himself, was going away with a brisk smile, when he fortunately remembered the occasion. Quickly becoming depressed again, he sighed, looked into the crown of his hat, as if for comfort, put it on without finding any, and slowly departed. Mrs. Gamp and Mr. Pecksniff then ascended the staircase, and the former, having been shown to the chamber in which all that remained of Anthony Chuzzlewit lay covered up, with but one loving heart, and that a halting one, to mourn it, left the latter free to enter the darkened room below, and rejoin Mr. Jonas, from whom he had now been absent nearly 2 hours. He found that example to bereaved sons, and pattern in the eyes of all performers of funerals, musing over a fragment of writing paper on the desk, and scratching figures on it with a pen. The old man's chair, and hat, and walking stick, were removed from their accustomed places, and put out of sight. The window blinds, as yellow as November fogs, were drawn down close. Jonas himself was so subdued, that he could scarcely be heard to speak, and only seen to walk across the room. Pecksniff, apostrophe he said, in a whisper, you shall have the regulation of it all, mind. You shall be able to tell anybody who talks about it, that everything was correctly and nicely done. There isn't anyone you'd like to ask to the funeral, is there? Apostrophe, apostrophe, no, Mr. Jonas, I think not. Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.